Well, good evening. I'd like to start with one thing. So I would like to devote this presentation to my friend, Professor Semih Tezcan, who died yesterday flying back from Berlin to Ankara. Whenever we talk about the civilizations or humanity, about the big sort of issues and big ideas, it's always better to start maybe from this nuclear relationship, you know, from a man-to-man relationship. And I'll be based on my own experience in that sense of, you know, how we are sort of witnessing, how we are living through the changes in mentality, in society, in reality, the tectonic changes, which are sort of, you know, claimed from the railway to the WWW. Because we're talking about the Ottoman Railway Network's centenary, let me start with Mahmud Khoja Behbudi, our Uzbek writer, who traveled to Hijaz, to Mecca in 1914 by train. So here is his account. Please play video.
June the 8th, 1914. We arrived in Istanbul. On June the 16th, in the evening, we took a train from Istanbul. Our companion was a Nemangan teacher and a respected person. The travel by train from Istanbul to Edirne takes 10 hours, and the railway is owned by the Austrian Christians. A second-class ticket costs 10 rubles. Poor Muslims have lived in Europe for 500 years and have become accustomed to European customs, clothing, and disagreeable deeds, but not to science and skills. And this is so everywhere. Until today, all Muslims combined have neither the ability nor the skill to build at least 1 mile of railway. But we cling perfectly, with all our strength, to cigarettes, drinking, and debauchery. The railway goes more than an hour inside the city. Then, from two sides, there are gardens, water reservoirs, barracks, security tents, enterprises, and factories. In some places, the train goes by the sea. The ruins of ancient buildings built by the Byzantines are still standing. But when the night falls, nothing can be seen in the darkness. It is impossible to sleep in European trains. 8 people sit in a 2-seater compartment. It is impossible to sleep or even to lay down. There are many Turkish officers on the train. The distance between Istanbul and Edirne is full of military barracks. In the morning, we arrived to Edirne.
So it's his semi-sarcastic account of his travel to Mecca. Funny enough, at the same time, my great granddad, Mahmud Khoja, the same name, you know, he was traveling to Mecca as well, but he traveled in 1911. And that was his account and his sort of, you know, first meeting with the railway. Could you please play the video?
In the steppe near Tashkent, not far from the river Gilas, they came upon a never-ending ladder whose rungs were of iron and which had to be laid across the earth from horizon to horizon. As Micah, struck dumb in the middle of his singing, was gazing despondently down at the ground in front of him, there was a high-pitched whistle in the distance. This whistle, similar to that of a hamster in the Iraqi sands, grew louder and deeper and suddenly acquired a fire-spitting face which filled Micah with indescribable terror. Bleating like uncastrated kids, the goats scattered about the vast steppe. The horses stumbled amid the sheep. Jibril and Mahmud Hodja wheezed and trembled and prayed towards Mecca. And then, with wild whistling and thundering, a snake-like wonder hurtled past them, packed both on the inside and on top with infidels, shouting and waving their hands. The end of the world, thought both Mahmud the Sunni and Jibril the Shiite.
It's an extract from my novel, The Railway. And because I'm sure that nobody here read any of my books, so because they are not translated, they are translated into many languages but German. So please believe whatever I say about my books. So, as you've seen in both cases, in both these trips, you can notice that the railway is something else, you know, not just the mean of traveling, mean of transportation. It's a symbol, it's a metaphor. In one case, it's a mean to go to Mecca, to God. In another case, it's the end of the world, a catastrophe for the world. Generally, the railway as a metaphor is very appealing to my mind as a writer. Okay. You know, usually you write not for the metaphors, not for the sort of concepts. You write what you are feeling. But then when you start to rationalize what you've written, you start to understand that there are some things which are sort of, you know, much bigger than your initial impulse. So, the railway as a metaphor, because the second railway, which I was talking about, the Turkestani railway, was built by Russians in the beginning of the century, and this year is the centenary of the Russian Revolution. It's good to discuss maybe a bit what was happening in the minds of people, what the railway, apart from the sort of, you know, colonial role, was playing in the minds of people. I'll start with Bakhtin, with the famous philosopher, Russian philosopher, who all of a sudden started to discuss the monologism in literature and dialogism. He compared the writing of Tolstoy to writing of Dostoevsky. He considered that Tolstoy, whatever the strength of this great writer is a monological writer. In what sense monological? So he is the author, he is the god of his novel, whereas Dostoevsky is a dialogical writer. He creates the world where people speak to people, where ideas are exchanged. In Tolstoy's case, he is the owner of the ideas, as the author. In case of Dostoevsky, the characters, the heroes of his novels are sort of, you know, protagonists and the owners, the ideas. It's interesting how do they use, for example, the symbol of the railway. You remember Anna Karenina. If you read Anna Karenina, you remember that the railway kills the main character. Anna Karenina is died under the train. Whereas in Dostoevsky, it's the predicate, it's the beginning of the conversation. In Idiot, for example, the Count Myshkin comes to Russia by the way of the train. It's the beginning of something, of his relationship with Rasputin and his relationship with the characters of the novel. It's interesting to see how two authors are developing this symbol of the railway. But generally, thinking even more wider, there was this development in geometry, against the classic understanding of geometry by Euclid, the Riemann and Lobachevsky were thinking about the spaces and spatial geometry. The same was happening in physics with the Einstein and relativity against the classic physics of Newton. In philosophy, Kant versus Gegel, or even later for versus Wittgenstein, and so on and so forth. In the arts, the same is happening in the arts at that time. Schoenberg, which is breaking the classic music of Bach and Beethoven, Picasso, who is breaking the classic tradition of Leonardo. So this metaphor means something, and let's think what this metaphor, what this change was about. I mean, got lots of changes in the beginning of the century. What was this about? Could you play, please, another video?
The crowd was turning nasty, and under this mind-numbing sun, the men's tall fur hats seemed like huge black flies. He hurried to close this meeting, if only under the pretext of it being time for the Muslims' midday prayers, and then hurried to the white tent to speak to the commander of the Cossack Railway Penal Detachment to warn him of possible trouble.
It seems to me that, railway worker is a epitome, is a quintessence of one way of thinking of this world, you know. We were discussing during the daytime, my colleagues Shahana and Zahra were saying about, ideology of colonialism, that the railway is the symbol of colonial power. But any linear thinking, any sort of, dictatorial thinking, be it Russian, for example, quest for the communism, for the for the paradise in this year, on this earth, for example, where people should have been brought by the means of this railway. So, in a way, that is the sort of, the essence of this linear thinking. And what we were discussing a bit earlier is, in fact, shift from the linear thinking or one-dimensional thinking, traditional thinking, to sort of modern, postmodern thinking, which is about, if we are talking about the traditional thinking as a monarchic one, as the elitist one, triangular. When I'm saying triangular, I'm meaning two lines which are giving the perspective, like in the classic art, for example, centered, hierarchic, vertical, and religious. That is, the religious is very important here. You've seen in the previous fragment that the Turkmens were turning this railway as the, stairs to heaven. Stairs to heaven. That was their mean to connect to God. Like they do on their graveyards, they put the stairs on their graveyards. They turned the railway upwards. And you can compare it with the postmodern thinking, democratic, common, squared. Remember the black square of Malevich in the beginning of the century. Edge thinking, bring the example of Derrida philosophy. It's about chaos, it's horizontal, it's atheist, and so on and so forth. It was happening not just in Russia because of the revolution, but in the West as well, in the Western thinking as well. In a way, there is an understanding that humankind sort of, lives in his phenotype, the whole genotype, the whole history of the previous generations and so on and so forth. When I looked at my novels, all of a sudden I noticed the same sort of development which I was talking about a bit earlier. For example, in my book, The Underground, and I once again believe what I'm saying about my books, The Underground is about a half-black, half-Hakassian boy living the end of the Soviet Union in Moscow. It's, in a way, a kind of example of Pushkin being born now in modern world. Pushkin, who symbolize the whole Russianness, the holy Russianness of the Russian mentality, is born during the end of the Soviet Empire. And all his life is happening in the tube, because there he finds himself at home, in the Moscow tube, which is one of the most beautiful underground systems of the world. And funny enough, the underground system of Moscow, in a way, is a symbol of the communism. Because one thing, the paradise was built beyond the sort of, enemy's eyes, the experiment where people equal to each other in the tube, everyone equals to each other. There are no sort of, monetary relationship, there are no any other relationships. So it was a communistic project under sort of, you know, under in underworld to build the world of equals. And Russians or the Soviets, they succeeded in it. But funny enough, in this novel, for example, this Mbobo, the main character, which I'm talking about, ends up the life of Anna Karenina. So apparently, the erosion of this railway system or the linear thinking, which was the communism as well, was concerning me when I was writing this novel. Or, for example, if you take another novel of mine, The Dead Lake, it's once again, it's about a boy, because one time it was interesting to me to write about the old man and the children, because in their lives, you've got the sort of entrance point to the to this life and the exit point. So I was interested very much in these two points. Here, the novel or novella is about the nuclear site where people lived while 468 explosions were carried out. And nobody cared about those people who were living there. And the child, the main character of this novel, he lives next to this site. He experienced all these, you know, explosions. And because of the mutation, he stops to grow at the age of 12. Whereas his beloved, who lives next to him, continues to grow. That is the novel. And here, you've got once again the idea of the exploded world, exploded railway, which was he was living at the station next to the site. So somehow the end of this linear thinking was reflected in a particular way in these novels, I think. This opposition is quite universal. Many, many years ago, I wrote a book which is called Arrows of Heaven and Spears of Earth, in which I compared two poems, one by Lorca, Federico Garcia Lorca, and another one by Khlebnikov, a wonderful, a genius of the Russian poetry. And what I discovered, both of them, they wrote the same poem. A poem, if you know, Romance de la Luna Luna of Lorca, it's about the, you know, a boy who is watching the moon, which is dancing in front of him, which is coming down and dancing in front of him, then takes this boy to the skies, whereas the gypsies are coming, they're trying to kill the moon, but in fact they're killing the child. That is the poem of Lorca. The same poem, The Lover of Juno, is written by Khlebnikov, completely autonomously. In that case, the Juno is coming to the earth, seduces the boy, dances in front of the boy, and steals him to the heaven. Whereas people, the others, they are trying to kill the Juno. So basically, it's the same poem, but when you start to research the means of writing these poems, starting from the sort of, you know, from the color which they are using, starting from the sonoric side, starting from the, you know, authorship, so you notice that two completely modes of thinking, of human thinking, are present here. In Lorca's case, everything is author-centered. So everything is internalized. Everything is about Lorca saying something about the world. Whereas in Khlebnikov's case, it's externalized. So things are saying for themselves, and Khlebnikov is just collecting all of that and trying to internalize. So this two modes of thinking are very interesting to explore. In the railway, in my novel The Railway, there are two sort of poles, in a way, of narration. One is a boy who is coming to this world, who is trying to understand the reality of this world, who intangible realities of this world, who is trying to explore this world, who is trying to experience everything through his own sort of personality. And there are others. The others, the sort of, you know, already stale existed, which whose life is a routine life, whose stories are told, retold, and retold many times, who are mythologizing these stories. But funny enough, you know, others, they are forming this boy. And this form, little by little, is becoming, and he is the person who constitutes the others. There is this balancing act between the sort of personality and the others. We always think that we are the first who sort of think about that, we are the first who are bringing these ideas together, and so on and so forth. But Central Asia is divided into parts of sort of population, the settled and nomadic part. Part is nomadic, all their traditions were nomadic for centuries, Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, and Turkmens. And another part, Uzbeks and Tajiks, are city dwellers. And when you compare their mentalities, it's two worlds once again, two worlds. If, for example, the settled, sedentary people are about religion, about the station, maqam is about the relationship with God, it's about the tree which is growing from the, you know, it's horizontal, vertically from the earth to the heaven, they are conservative and so on and so forth. The nomadic mentality is quite different. It's the opposite in a way. It's man to man. For example, when I researched the Kazakh poetry, I couldn't find any poem about God, for example. So everything is about man to man, is about the distances, is about new pastures, is about the horizontals. So to collect everything together, what I'm talking about, there are different modes of thinking this world. There are different metaphors for this world. And one of the shifts which we are living through, which we are maybe noticing, which we are maybe not noticing, which we are sort of, you know, witnessing, not witnessing, is the change and shift from the railway networks to the www, to the social media networks, social network networks. And from the reality, from the physical networks, we are shifting towards the virtual networks. And it's amazing to compare both of them, for example, material versus virtual, linear versus matrix, spatial versus time, continual versus instant, externalized versus internalized. And when you start to compare those things, on the one hand, you become very, very sort of optimistic. You start to believe that new generation of so-called generation Google is coming up in a way, who are playing the same games, who are thinking in a similar manner. Because while traveling, I noticed, for example, that the kids, for example, in Afghanistan, they are sort of in their mode of thinking are exactly like kids of London or kids of Moscow, for example. So there is this optimism that this instantaneous sort of connections from human to human are making some way through. But at the same time, as a sort of writer, you start to understand that not everything is smooth and thought through. My book, one of the latest books, which is called Father Islam and Other Uzbeks, somehow In a way, when I rationalize, I see that this linear thinking is giving up in this book, because it's not a linear novel. It's not a classic novel in how we do understand these novels. It's a novel of short stories. The fragmented world, in a way, is reflected in this novel, apparently. And fragmentation of this world, conflict of fault, linear thinking of borders, of walls, against the new world of instantaneous connections, bridges, global village, is present here. So all of us, we've seen this railway next to the WWW networks. And in a way, we are facing, all of us, this conflict of changing paradigms from linear thinking to something more complex thinking, from one-dimensional thinking to multi-dimensional thinking, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, we have to be aware that, even in virtual world, we are facing lots of challenges, and if to bring them to one word, I would say we are facing lots of prejudices. Lots of prejudices. They can play a role of the common sense. They can play a role of hide behind the traditions, behind the myths, languages, literature, reality, and so on and so forth. Yesterday, Adania talked about two stations in between which we are sort of finding ourselves. And I would like to set up these stations for myself as well. One Russian poet, Tютчев, said famously, "Мысль изречённая есть ложь," which means that the thought, as soon as it uttered, is becoming immediately a lie. To which, on the other hand, T.S. Eliot said, "Till human voices wake us and we drown." So, you may believe me, you might not believe, because even what I'm saying is becoming the next moment a prejudice. Whatever we are saying is becoming prejudice. Literature, for example, as soon as it uttered, is becoming a prejudice, a set of beliefs, a set of a railway between point A to B. But at the same time, I'd like to finish with one legend from our... I started with the Uzbek literature, and I would like to finish with one anecdote from Uzbek literature. Many, many years ago, in the medieval time, great Uzbek poet Alisher Navai lived. And once he remembers himself in his writing, he's saying, "I was standing next to Abdurrahman Jami." Abdurrahman Jami is one of the seven greatest poets ever lived this world, in a way. I'm standing next to Abdurrahman Jami, and he is asking me, looking at the peacocks which are walking in front of us. He is asking, "How the peacocks lay their eggs?" I just shrug my shoulders, and he says, "I read in some books in Husraf Dehlevi that the male drops a tear into the eye of the female, and that is the way they are lay eggs." And Navai all of a sudden says, "Really?" He says, "Really?" At the same time, he writes, "I was so embarrassed. The great Jami refers to great Husraf Dehlevi and says me the way they are laying eggs, and I dare not to believe. But at that time, the male catches the female, does everything in a natural way, and Jami is looking sarcastically at me and saying, 'Your reality wins.'" So, all I would like to say, whatever the prejudices, whatever the systems and so on and so forth we are thinking, but ultimately the reality, this wildly improbable or probable reality, will win. Thank you.